Good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network. Foster families are intended to provide safe, caring homes for children whose own families can't meet their needs. The idea is that it's temporary to give parents time to establish the right factors to effectively have their kids living at home. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about Wisconsin's need for foster families, what it's like to foster children, and the supports that exist for everyone involved. You're part of this conversation. There's a line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you're fostering a child. Why did you decide to foster? What has the experience been like? Maybe you work for a foster organization. What do you see when it comes to needs? 1-800-642-1234. Julie Zydek is the public adoption and foster care manager of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. Its goal is to offer housing programs to promote healthy communities for all ages, needs, and incomes. Julie, we appreciate you talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Julie, how do children come to be in foster care?
Usually the children have experienced some sort of trauma, like abuse and neglect in their birth family, and the children are removed to give the parents an opportunity to receive treatment and make their home suitable for the children again.
And what misconceptions can you clear up for us about foster care?
Foster kids are just like, you know, regular kids. They have experienced some trauma, but they just need a stable environment and to be taught, life skills, to have people who are in their corner to support them, do things with them, and, you know, help them heal from some of their past traumas.
So foster kids aren't perfect kids, just like any kid isn't a perfect kid. Does that apply to the adults then too in foster programs, that I assume that you don't have to be perfect to be a foster parent?
That is definitely correct. Children just need to be, you know, kids. They don't need to worry about a lot of our grown-up things. And the parent's job is just to be a parent, be a support. They can make a difference in the child's life, whether they're there for a month or there for 6 months. You know, really just having, just being that support and making a positive impact on these children's lives that can last a lifetime.
We're talking with Julie Zydek. She's the public adoption and foster care manager for Lutheran Social Services here. And we're taking your questions and experiences with foster care. You can call 800-642-1234. And we're welcoming another guest. Desi Hoffman is a foster parent living in Wisconsin. Desi and her wife are currently fostering a 6-year-old girl. Desi, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Yeah, so we are actually currently fostering a 16-year-old girl.
Excellent. And what has it been? Thank you for that. What has it been like to be a foster parent?
So being a foster parent, I want to say, is very rewarding, but it also comes with so many, complications and stuff too. Some of it is you don't necessarily know who the kid is, what they've gone through and stuff before they even come into your home. Sometimes you just get what is written down on paper, what is, I guess, word of mouth. So it's getting to know the child and understanding the trauma that they have gone through, but it's also really rewarding to see them grow in your home and see them grow in a community. And like you said in the beginning, the goal is mainly reunification so they can go back home to mom and dad. And it's also awesome to see the parents grow themselves as well for the love of their children.
How have you walked into this, or how have you made sure to have the right mindset when you know that you're going to be caring so deeply for someone in your home and the goal is that they don't stay there?
So with each foster child that comes in, you end up having a team with them. And like, we have a caseworker we're consistently working with, and she also helps, I guess, with that mindset too, is, you know, because there's frustrations. There's always going to be frustrations, even if you have your own bio children. And with talking to the caseworker and stuff like that, she can always, you know, like, hey, like, everything's going to be okay. Like, let's look at it this way and stuff like that. But it's also, I mean, a lot of it is dealing with the fact that my wife grew up next to a foster home. And both of my parents are actually adopted. And just hearing some of the struggles that have been gone through with other kids helps with that mindset, I guess. You know, you kind of got to put yourself in their shoes a little and understand, like, hey, okay, they've gone through this. So imagine if you were in their shoes.
We are talking with Desi Hoffman, who's a foster parent, and also Julie Zydek, who works with adoption and foster care. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Anna in Sauk City who wants to join our conversation now. Hey, Anna.
Hi there. I'm curious about whether you can imagine scenarios where working couples can foster kids, or is it pretty much a given that somebody needs to be home most of the time?
Anna, thank you so much for that question. And Julie, what about adults who need to work in foster care?
Yes, that's totally normal thing. We have many, we have some stay-at-home foster parents. We also have parents that both work out of the house. We have single parents. You know, depending on the situation of each foster family will help determine what type of child should be placed, you know, in that home and work to, you know, meet the needs of both the children and the families. So yes, we, you can be a foster parent, whether you work full time or a stay at home parent, it does not make a difference.
And when you try to place children with different families, then if you do have parents who work outside the home, does that mean they would usually get, you know, children of a certain age? Or does that mean that you work with families to try to establish, you know, appropriate child care, or if a child is old enough, can stay home by themselves? Could you talk more about that?
Yes, it doesn't. Yeah, it's not limiting based on you know, if a parent works or not, the age does not make a difference. But yes, we will work with you, with foster parents, to find appropriate child care if that's needed. And a lot of that, those costs too, are also covered by the state and county. So there is also, you know, some families worry about the cost of child care and that type of thing, but these, but foster children are eligible for daycare assistance. So that shouldn't be a need, fear either.
And Julie, you mentioned marital status is also not a barrier. What about income level or other demographic factors?
Yeah, you know, we just want foster families to be able to support themselves. There is no income, you know, that you have to make this amount of money. It's just that you can be self-supportive of your family.
And Desi, you are a foster parent. You happen to be married, although that's not one of the requirements. What was the process you and your wife went through so that you could foster a child?
So we luckily knew someone who is also licensed through LSS and got information from them. And we went and called that number, and they were very willing to help us walk through the process. I do have to say it is a lot of paperwork, and it can put you in, uncomfortable situations. But as me and my wife say, like, that's okay, because being a foster parent, you're going to come across many uncomfortable situations with the kids. It's just inevitable.
And what do you mean by uncomfortable situations? Just really assessing your family and being honest about it, or?
Yeah, and that is a huge factor. And just some of the things that happen within the kids in the home and things they've gone through. I mean, even certain conversations can be uncomfortable.
And yet you take them on.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because in my opinion, every child deserves love. Every child deserves support. Every child deserves a home.
Desi, thank you for that. We're talking with Desi Hoffman, who is a foster parent living in Wisconsin. And we're also talking with Julie Zydek of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234 while we explore the foster system and foster parenting and the supports there here in Wisconsin. You can also send your question to ideas@WPR.org. We're keeping the conversation going here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is the Ideas Network. The need for foster families in Wisconsin is significant. Thousands of children can benefit from safe, temporary homes while their own families develop the ability to nurture and protect them. The foster care system supports tiny babies to teenagers, and we're talking about what it takes here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guests are Desi Hoffman and Julie Zydek. Julie works in social services, and Desi lives in Wisconsin and is a foster parent right now. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see foster care in Wisconsin changed? Maybe there's an aspect of it you've seen that you want to talk about or ask a question about. Maybe you were in foster care. What should we know about your experience? You can share it now at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. The address is ideas@WPR.org. Julie, Ethan's Law is awaiting the governor's signature. The bill was created after a Manitowoc County boy named Ethan died under the supervision of his assigned guardians. What do you hope that this bill will do to improve the foster care system in Wisconsin?
Yes, I really think it's important that, you know, everyone knows. I mean, all foster parents do go through background checks, and we do our best to, you know, ensure, you know, that the children are placed in safe homes. And we definitely support any, you know, legislation or anything that's going to further enhance, you know, the ability to assure that, you know, foster parents, you know, are going to, you know, are a safe environment for these children.
And you talk about background checks and making sure that the right placement from the beginning. How do you continue to make sure that that home is still working for a child?
Yeah, so each child and home has a social worker assigned to them, you know, and so they do regular contacts and in-home visits, you know, to assure that, as well as we offer ongoing training. All foster parents need to have pre-placement training before a child is placed in their home, and then, you know, initial ongoing training, you know, up to like 36 hours initially, and then continuing on after that. So, you know, just with the education and also with the supervision and teaming with the caseworkers, we use that to make sure that the family is doing well and that the children are thriving as well.
Desi, had you fostered a child before this time?
Yes, we had fostered two children before this.
And so with the training that Julie is talking about, before you started this whole journey, combining that training with the things that you had learned, did you feel prepared? And did you feel like you could keep asking questions along the way?
Absolutely. We definitely did feel prepared. But I guess the one thing that you are never fully prepared for is when they go home.
What do you mean?
Okay, so you go through all these classes, and they teach you so much stuff. It's so informational. Like, I recommend them to people who even aren't foster parents, just so you can understand what some of these kids have gone through. And in these classes, they talk about a lot, but I guess it's when it's right in front of you and you see this child having to, you know, slowly pack their things because they're going home, and you've grown this bond and you care about them so much. It's bittersweet. You're sad because they're leaving, but you're also happy because they're moving forward to something they wanted. They're going back home. And I mean, I cry every time. Every single time a child leaves my home, I cry.
Julie, It sounds like that bond, that relationship and caring for children is probably, you know, what you hope for when it comes time for foster kids to go back to their own homes.
Definitely. You know, it's invaluable, the relationship that these children build with their foster parents. Sometimes it's, you know, the first healthy relationship they've had with, you know, a caregiver. And, you know, then they can, they learn what a positive relationship can be like. And, you know, the birth parents can, you know, learn these things too. They're involved in the process. And when these children go home, you know, what a blessing that the foster parents have given these children, you know, to feel that love and, you know, that they have someone in their corner helping them. It can only help them, you know, be successful in the future.
We're talking with Julie Zydek, who is a foster care manager here in Wisconsin. We're also talking with foster parent Desi Hoffman. Still time for your question at 800-642-1234 as we talk about this on the Ideas Network. Julie, I understand that foster parents are paid while a child is in their care. How does that work?
Yes. So each child does come with an adoption subsidy, which they, or not an adoption, a foster care subsidy, which they do get paid monthly. And it's to cover the basic needs of the children. And as well, so it's based on the needs of the child. So it's individualized. So there's a basic payment that every foster parent gets, and then additional funds depending on the needs of the children, like if there's a lot of visitation with birth parents that the foster parents have to, you know, take the child to and from, or a lot of appointments. So it is based on the needs of each individualized child.
And you mentioned earlier that something like child care would be an eligible service for kids in foster care. What about medical expenses for kids?
Yep. Medical, it's all children in foster care are eligible for assistance through the county. So there are no medical fees for foster parents. Those are covered through medical assistance.
When children leave their foster homes and are reunited with their families, do the adults that took care of them, are they able to stay in contact, or is it really goodbye?
It's really dependent on the situation. I know of families that have been able to stay in contact and be a resource, and some families, birth families, don't want that, and it, you know, they may not continue contact. So it is dependent on each specific situation.
Okay. And Desi, what is a memory that you've made so far in fostering that you want to share so that people can better understand what you do?
Oh, I have many memories. I would say one of the biggest memory is with each kiddo, you end up feeling this, I don't know, like this click with them at one point. And it's amazing when you feel that. And it's amazing when you, I guess, feel that they care too, and they're starting to realize, like, hey, I'm safe, everything's going to be okay. And I mean, even having a kiddo call you after they've left your house is amazing as well.
That's happened to you?
Yes, it has. We're actually in contact with a kiddo, and they are coming to stay a weekend just to say hi.
Oh, how neat. What opportunities do you see, or what challenges do you see as you continue to foster parent, Desi?
That's kind of a hard question, because you always come across different challenges. I think the biggest challenge will always be to get to know the individual kiddo and just get them, I guess, like, comfortable in your home.
Sure. What do you want to tell someone who's thinking about fostering a child?
Do it. It's awesome. It's rewarding. And there's always someone there to answer questions.
Mm. Desi, thank you for sharing your very personal experience with us.
You're welcome.
And Julie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Julie Zydek is the Public Adoption and Foster Care Manager of Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. Desi Hoffman is a foster parent living in Wisconsin. Desi and her wife are currently fostering a 16-year-old girl. They joined us to talk about support and training for foster families in Wisconsin. Thousands of kids in our state need loving, safe places to live temporarily. Ahead, we have a story of our Wisconsin life. Then we examine the amount of carbon in the atmosphere after an historic high was reported in May. A climate scientist is here to discuss why the carbon levels remain high and what it'll take to reduce levels in our atmosphere. News is next. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead, we're looking at the fact that the world put less carbon into the air last year because of lockdowns, but we've got more CO2 in the atmosphere now than we've ever measured before. You can join that conversation ahead on the program. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about a grandfather clock and a fond family memory.
Singer James Taylor wrote, "The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time. Try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride." WXPR's Ben Meyer has the story of a loving couple, a clock that ticked as time passed, and the person who repaired that timepiece, keeping the couple's memories alive.
It was 1957, and Rhinelander's Leona Forth laid eyes on Marv Schumacher for the first time. The blind date blossomed into a marriage the next year.
He was the most generous, he was the best guy in the world.
Time passed, and on their 25th wedding anniversary, they bought themselves a treat.
This guy was selling clocks, and we looked at this one, and I said, "Oh, I think that's such a neat clock. Why don't we consider this will be our anniversary gift to each other?" So we went, that's what we did.
The grandfather clock kept ticking as grandkids were born, kept ticking past the couple's 50th anniversary celebration. But a few years ago, Marv was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and dementia started to creep in.
That dragged out it was a long 8 months.
On April 24th, 2019, just after the couple's 61st anniversary, Marv Schumacher passed away. The home they shared fell into silence, without Marv and with a grandfather clock that hadn't chimed in years. At some point, Leona called Stacy Wagler, another Rhinelander man who did clock repair on the side.
I was so impressed how his love, he treated that like he was treating a newborn baby.
After a few hours of tender repairs, a chime, a sound seeming to bring back the presence of Leona's husband.
Oh my gosh, it was just like, oh, I just miss this. So it just warmed my heart. So I was happy. It just made me feel warm. Okay, Marv, I know this is what you want.
It's clock stories like those that stick in Stacy Wagler's mind.
To be able to service these clocks so they can better remember their a better time or a family member or something like that. Struck 2 o'clock.
His repair shop, Wind Me Up Clock Shop in Rhinelander, is full of stories, memories, and, of course, clocks.
The tick and the tock that you're listening to, that is what they call the beat.
For the past few years, Wagler had been stuck in a different rhythm, working a stable but demanding full-time corporate job while trying to fit in his passion for clock repair on the side. He says the pandemic and loved ones helped flip his priorities. At his wife's encouragement, he quit his job in December and now focuses only on clocks.
And no regrets so far?
No. No.
This is the real heavy one.
At Stacy Wegler's suggestion, Leona Schumacher puts on gloves to wind her grandfather clock.
Very gently and very...
That way, the oils on her fingers won't damage the brass. The clock needs winding every 3 days to keep it ticking and chiming. And each time it chimes, her husband Marv is there.
Ben Meyer is the special topics correspondent at WXPR in Rhinelander. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. In spring of 2020, lockdowns around the world meant way fewer people were using cars and planes and other pollution-producing transportation. In early April of that year, researchers found carbon dioxide dropped by 17% from the previous year. And yet, we've now learned that scientists recorded an historic peak of carbon in the atmosphere since we started keeping accurate records 63 years ago. What questions do you have about this? Call us now at 800-642-1234. What do you think will happen? Are you concerned about the fact that there's so much carbon in our atmosphere? Do you worry it's too late to affect our changing climate? 800-642-1234. Our guest is Galen McKinley. She's an earth and environmental sciences professor at Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, where she studies the carbon cycle. And she also taught at UW-Madison from 2004 until 2017. Galen, welcome back to the Ideas Network and Wisconsin.
Thank you. It's great to be back in Wisconsin. Hi, everyone.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that we now have 419 parts per million of carbon in our atmosphere. What does that mean?
Well, it means we have, by human activity, raised the carbon level in the atmosphere very rapidly over where it was at the start of the Industrial Revolution to a level that hasn't been seen in our atmosphere for many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years.
And obviously, we weren't keeping track at those points. So how do we know that?
Yeah, well, we don't have direct records like we do, like you said, for 63 years from the top of mountains in Hawaii and other places around the world. But we do have ice cores, and ice cores can trap bubbles of carbon dioxide and other gases in the atmosphere as the ice gets compacted year after year. And then people go to Greenland and ice and Antarctica and drill out those ice cores and can recover the carbon that was trapped in bubbles in the ice. And so that's how we can go back now about 600,000 years we can go back with really high accuracy measurements, and people are working on going back even to a million years. There's new efforts. So we do have good records of that. And we also know that as the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere has varied over both millennial timescales now more recently in the last decades, that as we put more carbon in the atmosphere, the climate warms. And we also understand the physics of that very well, how the greenhouse effects works. And so what it means that we have high carbon in the atmosphere now means is that we're continuing to warm the planet by our emissions, mostly by burning fossil fuels.
So we spewed less carbon into the atmosphere in the pandemic, and yet we still see it increasing. How does that work?
Right. Well, the way I like to think about it is a bathtub. If you have a reservoir in your bathtub, and you have both water going in and water coming out, but you're putting more water in than coming out, you end up with the level rising over time. And even if you turn down the spigot just a little bit and slightly less water is going in at the top, you still have a certain amount coming out at the bottom. You're still going to raise that bathtub even if you turn down the water a little bit. So our emissions are essentially that flow of water into the bathtub. We're adding carbon at a certain rate. every year. And we do have sinks in the ocean and in the land, biosphere in particular, that remove some of that excess carbon, but they're not as big as the sources. So in recent decades, we've put on the order of 10 petagrams of carbon per year in the atmosphere, but those sinks remove only about 5 petagrams of carbon per year. So every year, we accumulate about 5 in the atmosphere, and that's why the atmosphere keeps going up. Now, last year, we reduced those emissions by about only about 6.4% over the whole year of the 2020. And so, you know, we've turned down the spigot a little bit, but we haven't stopped the increase.
We've got a related question here as we're taking calls at 800-642-1234. I want to welcome Tony from Egg Harbor. Hey, Tony.
Good morning. At the height of the pandemic, what was the global average of carbon in the atmosphere, parts per million? And do climatologists feel that if that number were achieved without a global pandemic, would that stem the tide of climate change? And if not, then a global pandemic didn't even stem the tide of the production of carbon dioxide. What is the solution?
Tony, thank you so much for that question. Galen.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. So the rise of atmospheric CO2 that it was shown, for example, in the data that has been discussed in the media last week, this time last year, we were at about 416 parts per million, 416 to 417 parts per million, and now we're at 419. There's a seasonal cycle that also is imposed there that goes up and down a little bit higher at this time of year, a little bit lower at the end of the summer growing season. But essentially, that steady rise has not been significantly slowed by the pandemic. And that is because we had a very temporary shutdown in our fossil fuel emissions, not shutdown, but a slowdown in our emissions. And that was mostly just by slowing down the emissions from cars and trucks on the road and airplanes. But transportation is only about 20% of all of our emissions, in fact. And so we were still burning fossil fuels to heat our homes and to have electricity and to run our computers on our dining room tables, of course. So it is true that we did have dramatic change to our activity, and we did not see a significant change in the rise of atmospheric CO2. And what I think this indicates is the need for systemic change in the way we produce energy at the base, at the core, right? So instead of burning coal and natural gas to generate electricity that powers the lives we live, we should be using more and more renewables and wind and hydropower and geothermal, and also investing in inefficient transmission and all the things that reduce our net use of fossil fuel energy. So I think that the fact that we didn't have a big change in the atmosphere is indicative of both the need to transform more globally in terms of our way we produce energy, and also it shows us that the changes we make have to be sustained. We can't just make a small a change over a short period of time and it's going to solve the problem. These are sustained changes that have to happen for the long term. It's how we build our power plants and how we build our cities and how we decide to get around on a day-to-day basis and what cars we choose to buy, things like that, that are going to make the bigger difference in the long term.
Galen McKinley studies the carbon cycle. She's an earth and environmental sciences professor at Columbia University. She stays with us as we consider what new numbers tell us about our changing climate. I'm Keely Boltina. We want to hear from you here on the Ideas Network. Give us a call with your question at 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. Our climate is changing, and scientists say it's going to take intentional shifts around the world over a stretch of time for us to reverse course. For example, we put out less carbon dioxide last year, and yet we still hit a record last month for the amount of it in our atmosphere. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is a climate scientist and Columbia professor, Galen McKinley, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Mike from Wauwatosa on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
What are you thinking about when we have this discussion about carbon?
Well, first of all, I'm grateful that we're having the discussion at all. I think it doesn't get all the coverage it deserves. I mean, there's a lot of other things to cover, but this is super important. So my question is, President Biden has set a very aggressive target for 2030 for reducing emissions, but I'm not really seeing the policies that would correspond with that level of ambition right now at the federal level. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that and whether there are policies coming forward that would match the scale of the problem.
Mike, thanks for the question. Galen McKinley, what do you see as far as real intentional movement and policy?
So I am much more a climate scientist than a policy expert. So I will speak from what I know without Fair. Being an expert on the Biden plan and what's actually happening on the ground. What I see in the infrastructure commitments that are being worked on in Congress right now is a commitment to really important things. For example, charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. You know, one of the reasons gas vehicles work so well on our roads today is because at every exit on the highway, there's a gas station and you can fill up. Well, if we had similar infrastructure for our charging of electric vehicles at every exit from the highway, then it would be easier for people to buy electric vehicles. For example, this is one of the reasons Tesla has been so successful. It's not only the cars that are very nice, but it's also because they've invested in the charging infrastructure. So you know you can drive from New Jersey to Wisconsin in your Tesla and make sure you know you'll be able to charge along the way. So that's important. And I think also there are a lot of investments in renewable energy, the kinds of systemic changes that need to happen, and support for people to do that across the country is absolutely critical. So it is about infrastructure. A lot of what we're talking about cutting our emissions is about infrastructure and how we generate our energy, how we transport ourselves. For example, investments in trains from the administration, putting Amtrak back through Madison, for example, I think is very exciting. And I really hope that this comes to pass because this is absolutely critical.
So if we do the right things and lower our emissions, how long could it take before we actually start to see improvements?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And that's something that we're a lot of people are working on trying to understand because we do have right now, for example, we put about 10 petagrams of carbon per year emitted globally into the atmosphere, and only about 5 stays there because we have these sinks on the terrestrial biosphere and in the ocean. The bad news is that those sinks, once the pressure from the atmosphere of ever-increasing concentrations is sort of relieved a bit, those sinks will start giving some carbon back to the atmosphere. So there will be an equilibration period in which, even though we're cutting our emissions, some of the excess carbon, for example, that's stored in the surface ocean, will start to return back to the atmosphere. So we have to get through that equilibration timescale, that period, that's natural, unavoidable consequence of just the way our Earth system works, and get over that until we start really seeing reductions. So I think the first thing we need to look for is just a plateauing of the concentration in the atmosphere. That's going to be the first indicator of great success. And then it'll be, probably a decade or so of kind of flat levels, and then we'll start seeing things going down. But at this point, we just need to stop the rise, right? If we could just stop going up from 419 to 421 to 423 to 425, if we could just stop that rise, that would be huge success and would immediately stop warming. It would immediately stop the increasing rate of warming of the planet. We'd still have warming happening, but we wouldn't be adding and adding and adding to our problem. And there is evidence that we would see impact on the climate relatively quickly by just flattening the rate.
Galen McKinley is an earth and environmental sciences professor at Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. And we're talking about carbon emissions and the climate. What did climate scientists learn from this pandemic?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about the pandemic is that the scientific community has really woken up to the question of what's going to happen when we cut our emissions, and how are we going to see that in our observations of the atmosphere, the land, the ocean? How are we going to be ready to observe these changes as they occur, to explain them to the general public, to policymakers as they occur? So there's been a lot of activity, a lot of papers written about the effects on air quality, for example, of cutting emissions from transportation, of how the degree to which we can see the change in the ocean uptake with the cut in the rate of emissions, for example, a lot of work. And we're also, so we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about how limited our capacity is to see these rapid changes in the Earth system. And, you know, this information that we've seen from NOAA, that the rate of the growth in the atmosphere just sort of is continuing on, is one indicator of how kind of the fact that this is a very, the whole atmospheric concentration is a, you know, is a massive steamship moving forward, and it's going to take a lot to turn it. We have to not only do a lot in terms of all of our cutting of emissions, but we also have to do a lot in terms of being ready to observe how those changes are having an effect in the Earth system.
Galen, you're an expert in what could be a human apocalypse. What are you seeing that gives you hope?
Well, I am very hopeful with the very rapid change with the Biden administration from a completely ignoring the problem of climate change to an immediate recognition of its importance, and the relatively bipartisan view of that, and the fact that this really is something that we need to do. I'm also really hopeful by the younger generations of people who are out there, who are no hold barred, committed to making the changes that need to happen here. And I do believe that we have turned a corner on the climate denialism, and we recognize that, you know, this is just something we have to deal with. Let's stop pretending, sticking our proverbial heads in the sand, and let's start addressing the issue, both in the area of mitigation, cutting those emissions, and also in the area of adaptation, recognizing that we have to be getting prepared for a changing climate in all the different ways that the climate affects all of our infrastructure, our cities, our societies, our coastlines. It's really exciting to see the attention that's being paid, but it is a big challenge, and we're all going to have to contribute to the solution.
Galen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
Galen McKinley is an Earth and Environmental Sciences professor at Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, where she studies climate change and the ocean's role in it. She also taught at UW-Madison from 2004 to 2017. We talked about how it's possible that pandemic lockdowns decreased carbon dioxide output worldwide, and yet scientists confirmed we have more carbon in the atmosphere now than we've ever reliably measured before. Just ahead, we talked to a psychologist about the best way for teens to spend their summer. It's been a hard year, and she says it's time we cut them some slack. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.